Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I would say a very disappointing result, not being as colorful as he is in that description. But it was a tough loss. No regrets, because we believe we did the right thing and we worked very hard in our campaigns to convey that to the American people. As I have to make a decision about what I do next, it certainly weighs in on how my real accomplishment in life is being a mom and a grandmother. I keep thinking they're going to be able to do all these things with me, and they like the idea that I can do things for the American people.
When you do things to the American people, Ms. Pelosi. The Queen of Mean, interviewed by somebody on ABC whose name I don't remember, saying that she has no regrets for having wrecked the American economy and wrecked the Democrat Party because she worked very hard. Well, she really did bring sensitivity and kindness to this position, I must say. The part I like best about this is how they go on and on about the women in government and how what a struggle it's been. They then go back to the fake civil rights issue of women, as though there's some kind of superior virtue of a woman. Has anyone found in their life that women are necessarily of superior virtue to men? If so, would you please instruct me as to how and where? I certainly don't see it on The View. I don't see it in government. Can you name one woman who entered government who's actually kinder and gentler than a man? In fact, but what I see is that the men are actually too kind and too gentle, to be frank with you. But it's all politics. It's all behind us. Will it remain to be seen whether it'll be cannoli or ravioli that she goes into? I don't know what it'll be. I wish her luck with whatever she takes on. I myself, in honor of the president's upcoming visit to India, he is taking 34 warships to India, $200 million a day. The same schmuck on CNN, the same Putztecher, that's an old German phrase for a moron, the same Putztecher, whatever his name is on CNN, the Schmendrick with the white hair, who has the lowest possible ratings below that of a buffalo with brucellosis. And yet he's revered by, for some reason, I forget, Anderson Blooper, has the nerve to say, well, there's no proof that it's $200 million a day. Where'd they get that from? This is the same guy who sneered at Tea Party candidates. If you remember, he used derogatory that only those in a certain subculture would understand. How the guy keeps his job is no mystery to me. The same people who run CNN are those who would permit women with brucellosis on the air. So what can I say to you? But in honor of the fact that the president is spending $200 million a day, as I say, to go to India, taking 34 warships, trains, planes, and air, I never saw anything like that. The U.S. military is reportedly building a kilometer-long bomb-proof tunnel so Obama can go up to the Gandhi Museum. No one can believe this. They're removing coconuts from trees so the president can be safe. I think they should just denude all of India with Agent Orange to make it even safer. I think that, you know, there's no sense in taking any chances. I think that they should spray all of India with Agent Orange and force all of the Indians out of the country for the trip to India. Maybe they can go to Bangladesh for the day. You know, the population. They can go to Pakistan and Bangladesh for a day. And let the Obamas really enjoy the country, because it's not made for the people of India. It's for a royal to visit from America. But in light of the fact that the Obamas, I say, are visiting India, I decided to go to an Indian buffet today. And even below that, I took it one rung below an Indian buffet. I actually had my assistant go out and get takeout Indian buffet. If you think that I have a power lunch, you're right. Because there's no greater power lunch than a takeout Indian buffet in my own studio with my dog present. What do I want to go to a restaurant for and listen to people? There's no reason to sit in a restaurant. The food isn't any better. It's just warmer. I don't understand the beauty of my friends in the business are going to get mad at me. I don't like fine dining. I don't even like dining. I like eating. When eating became dining is the same time when pasta became spaghetti. You know what I'm saying? When I grew up, it wasn't called pasta. It was called spaghetti. It was $4.99, $1.99. Then they renamed it pasta, became $10.99. It's the same thing with dining as opposed to eating. Whatever happened to eating? If a person says they're eating, does that make them automatically a prole? All right, so I'm a prole. I do not have the patience. People say to me, why don't you like to go to dinner? They call it a nice dinner. I don't like nice dinners. I can't even digest food. I cannot digest during a business meal. Do you know that? I don't even eat during a business meal. I don't even drink during a business meal. I'm one of those guys who orders water. So as I say, because the president is going to India, I had an Indian takeout, and consequently I have indigestion. It was quite tricky to navigate this. I have to tell you the truth. You know how a buffet is, right? It's all you can eat. Now, what's happening is this poor guy opened this up, and the middle-class people stopped going to the takeout because, you know, the food quality isn't the best. And it's all the poor, hardworking, illegal alien laborers who found out that it's all you can eat. They're eating them into the poorhouse. I mean, they have no what do you think? They care about a fellow third worlder? You never saw anything like it. It looks like there was a slaughterhouse in there when they get through. I mean, you know, there's like a certain – it's a social contract. If you go into an all-you-can-eat, you have to have a certain degree of understanding with the poor owner, who's usually a third worlder, right? So you eat a little bit more than you normally would. These guys have a plate of bones up in the plate. It looks like, as I say, a pyramid that was found, like a pyramid, a slaughter pyramid somewhere in Kwajalein-Gemoukle. So as I say, he's going out of business. So I figured I would take advantage of it myself and order a little bit more. So I said, look, I know it's usually one box for the $8.99. I'm starving. I won't go into the details any more than I already have because I know that you don't want to talk about this. I think what you want to talk about is your inability to buy trickle-up poverty, why Nancy Pelosi was the worst and meanest woman in the history of America. It's unbelievable to me how they get it. I never saw anything like it. She destroyed the Democrat Party. Obama's like basically comes across as a fairly nice guy, but he surrounds himself with pretty bad people, mean people, horribly mean people. And they are the people who are taking the flack. Frankly, he probably looks like a decent guy. Yes, he's a Leninist, but it doesn't mean he's bad. I mean, there's some capitalists I hate. It's the same. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean that, like, because they're capitalist economically that I like them. Do you understand that? Do you understand how that works? That just because a person is politically on my side of the things that I don't necessarily like them, nor is the reverse necessarily true. Some of the nicest people I've ever met are kind of ignorant liberals. They don't mean any harm. They don't hurt anybody. They just want to be left alone and leave you alone. They don't even understand they're being, you know, used. It's a very complicated story. It's like, I'm in favor of Israel. I'll make it a hot-button issue. Israel is the best nation in the Middle East. The rest are third-world throwback nations. Women are treated like animals. Do I have to go down the list and read you the riot list of how human... There are no human rights in the Middle East except in Israel. Let me spell it out for you. Zero human rights. Okay? So for that reason alone, I'm in support of Israel. Let's put it that way. But I don't like Israelis. I never met an Israeli I could get along with because they remind me of the New York, you know, Jewish people that I ran from. They're like the people who would elbow you on getting on the bus to go to high school, only worse because they're from another world and they're from a tougher neighborhood. And I understand it. It's the same with Russian people. I generally like Russian people, but I don't like their politics. So how do you figure that out? I don't even care if the Russians are communists. I like them. I don't understand. It's a certain thing. It's an understanding. I don't even ask them what their politics are. I don't want to know the Russians' politics, but I generally get along with Russians. It's the same with Irish. I never had an argument with an Irish person. I don't understand why that is. On the other hand, I generally don't get along with the English, and I don't know why that is. See, so it's very subjective. That's the absolute truth. So let's have a little traveling music, as Jackie Gleason used to say. I don't want to break. I just want to pause, and then I'm going to come back for a minute or two and give you a little bit of more of a spritz here on the Savage. Mommy, guys, play a little music while I'm catching my breath. They know I love this music. I used to collect plants in the Fiji Islands as a botanist. I spent many a lonely day in rainy apartments, horrible third world apartments in Suva, in between collecting trips. And all I could get on the radio would be whiny music like this. Play it. I go out for horrendous bone curry. They would slaughter the goat in the back of the store. It was awful. And then I had this translated by an Indian friend who told me what it means in Hindi. What it means is, why can't I have Mercedes? My sister-in-law has Mercedes. Why you buy me a Kia? I was shocked to find that out. Why no Mercedes? I was just shocked to find that it was all about the type of car that they were buying their wives. I'll be right back. We continue our singing for certain cars in the Savage Nation. You got to hand it to the Indian culture. They gave us the Kama Sutra thousands of years ago. Think about it. Long before Pfizer gave us Viagra. And they were quite limber, I mean, and quite athletic. If you look at the drawings from the Kama Sutra, unbelievable. I mean, there must be something about that cumin with regard to joint health, you know. Got to look into it. So, you know, don't knock it. I mean, don't knock ancient remedies and stuff. But anyway, here we are today, and it's the post-election blues. Not to me. I actually feel great. I was up all night preparing for... I'll never do this as long as I live again. My publicist booked, like, okay, you know when I go on the air, on the East Coast, it's in the afternoon, early evening. The West Coast is in the afternoon. So I don't like to go to work at 6 o'clock in the morning Pacific time. You know, it's the old joke. Yeah, I love getting up 13 hours before I go to work. Well, and when I'm getting up to do a show at 7 in the morning, which I had to do today, I was up all night. It's the same when I fly. I don't know what it is. I got it from my mother, the same gene. If I'm going to fly the next day, I don't care what the alarm clock says. I'm up at 1. Everything was so whacked out last night. I got up. It was 5 after 1, but it, like my eyes weren't working. I thought it was 5 after 6. I got up and got out of bed, brushed my teeth. The dog looked like I was crazy. I said, it's still very dark out to myself. I looked at the clock. I said, idiot, it's 5 after 1, not 5. It's like 1. So I don't know. It was crazy. So then you try to go. How could you go back to sleep at that point? You cannot. You fake it out. You know, you close the lights. Yeah, I'm really tired. You can't sleep. My mind is racing. All of my problems and this and that. Turmeric, cumin, cardamom, ginger, garlic, mace, and nutmeg is in a good curry. Very nice. Well, it's very nice. Very good. I guess I won't need the blue pill. No, forget about that. Yeah, we don't. You know, when you start already going to the Viagra jokes, you know you're in trouble. I don't even want to go there. So instead of going to Viagra jokes, let's go to a bigger joke and let's play Barack Obama. No, here's a bigger joke than a bad Viagra joke. Here's a man named Dan Rather who lost his job a number of years ago for lying about George Bush. And he goes on to more snotty nonsense by communists and says this.
He has to realize that Mitch McConnell has virtually said so that politically he wants to cut out his heart and throw his liver to the dogs. He has to be a fighter. His reputation as president so far is he's a little soft. He plays soft. He's got to demonstrate, and I think in this news conference, yes, I will work with him, but I'm prepared to fight him on things that really matter to me.
Dan, isn't it time you left stage left and never came back? Can't you just have the goodwill, Dan Rather, to take a job at the University of... they have a college, a community college somewhere in North Texas where you could teach communications. You know, the communications departments are filled with people who once hoped to be like working news. They all go into communications and the poor kids have to put up with it. Dan Rather could take a job like that at a community college teaching communications. It's time for him to go. You should hear the bad behavior out there going on, the anger and the bad behavior going on. It's horrible to listen to this stuff. Like Bonnie Frank. You're not going to believe this guy. I mean, he's an easy buffoon to mock, okay? I'm not surprised that he won in his own district. It's filled with nuts and miscreants, okay? But listen to Barney Frank. Listen to this.
This was a very important campaign to win. I was very much disappointed in the tenor of the campaign. And yes, I am happy and grateful to all those who helped me.
I can't even listen to him. There's no humor in this. What do you mean the tenor of the campaign? You were one of the most vicious of all of them. You made up stories that people said things they never said. Why don't you tell us about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Why don't you tell us about the number of Big Macs that you ate while pushing forward Fannie Mac and Freddie Mae? Why don't you tell us about the number of Big Macs that you could... Oh, Barney, I'm not going to be happy until Fannie Mae and Freddie whatever are investigated by the new Republican Congress and you finally are marched out in an orange jumpsuit. This is a nightmare to listen to this. You know what really is getting me crazy after this election is to listen to the psychos on MSNBC and in other denizens of stupidity, more snotty nonsense by commies, who are saying that they don't want to listen to the gridlock. They don't want bipartisanship. There's going to be further gridlock. These schmucks are actually giving themselves away. They're telling you, they're telegraphing that they're really wanting a dictatorship. They wanted a communist dictatorship where there is no gridlock. The only nations where there's no gridlock would be in a dictatorship. The mark of a healthy democracy is where there's argument and gridlock when people don't agree. Thank God we had gridlock or we'd have a total communist nation today. I would like some applause for that. If this was a live auditorium, I know you'd be applauding. Because I was right. Gridlock is the only thing that stopped Obama's communist agenda from going full bore. Now we've got to undo all the damage he's done by fighting everything he's done and taking it apart and starting anew. Take it all down, man. Bring it all down, man. Take down the campaign finance reform bill. Take down Obamacare. Take down the takeover of GM. Take it all down, man.
Savage. I wonder who wrote the book of love. Chapter one says the lover, you love with all your heart.
When this song came out, I think I was in high school with a crew cut. I don't know what. Play it louder. I want to remember. I want a reminiscence.
The meaning of romance.
59 Chevy, maybe. Yeah, like around there. One of the guys I knew, I told you, became a famous rock and roll singer for 2 years. We were schlepping to high school, college. He was in Japan. He was 16 years old. Huge rock and roll hit. We were so jealous. Came back, had a Jaguar, like a 21-year-old girlfriend. Eventually, though, you know, he flashed out and he went to work for the post office in Woodstock, New York. There's nothing wrong with being a postman. No, I'm serious. You know, if you get it young, you usually don't have it your whole life. It's guys like me who struggled for 40 years who finally, you know, can enjoy the fruits of their success. You know, did you ever think about that? Would you rather have it young? What if God gave you a choice? You can't have it your whole life, okay? You're either going to struggle your whole life and have it when you're older, okay? Or you're going to have a tremendous burst of success when you're young, and then in middle age, you're going to basically have nothing. I mean, which one would you take? You know that you would go for the first one if you were young, because you don't think you don't think tomorrow's ever coming, right? Now, what does it have to do with politics? I think Obama's very much like that adolescent. He doesn't understand that he has squandered his youth with this socialism, his political wad. He cannot push anything forward ever again. He has been found out, discovered. The mask has been taken off. His extraordinary expenditures are being exemplified this weekend with this grotesque trip to India. If the man had truly been humbled by this election, as he claims he has been, chastened in some way, he hasn't. What he would do is say, you know, in light of the fact that I realize most Americans don't like this government spending, I'm canceling this trip to India because it was going to cost $200 million a day, and I really don't think we need a junket to India, and I'm not taking 3,000 people in warships. I'm canceling it. His popularity would soar, but he won't do that because he still has hubris. He still has hubris. The man still thinks he's, above it all. And that's it. Maybe that's good for all of us. So as I say, this friend of mine, I mean, that song reminded me of that. That's how I got back to politics. When you are as political as I am, everything is political. I don't care if it's a bad Indian meal or a good Italian meal. I don't care if it's a Chinese meal that has your lipstick together. For example, I go to a certain Chinese restaurant generally on Tuesdays. It's terrible. But I've been going there for so long that it's a part of the geography of my week. And I don't feel right unless I go there and have my lipstick together. So people say to me, if you eat there and your lipstick together afterwards because it's so greasy, why do you go back? I said, because I'm comfortable there. Like when I look at the dish, which has the name of the restaurant on it, I feel stable. And it's worth having my lipstick together. But I could make that political and say I only wish that all the Democrats ate there every day, three meals a day. Symbol shot. Okay, you get it? Everything can be made political. It's like the Bible. If I read the Bible, what's the difference? Most people don't even know what I'm talking about. I'm talking too fast. For example, the other day, I told you that it came out that brucellosis, a lethal illness, occurred in the buffalo herd that Ted Turner had out there in Wyoming or wherever. They all got brucellosis. An epidemic hit the buffalo. So I said, I suspect that it may be a result of the women from The View having visited Jane Fonda and having violated the tenets of Leviticus. I would think one out of 25,000 listeners laughed at that. But those who laughed at that particular quip, which I made up on the spot, probably turned their car over. And I apologize to you if I caused an accident, because it is hilariously funny. I don't have a writer. What I have is a sense of humor, which is something that is lacked today, believe me, in the media. Trust me on that one. It's a blessing to have a sense of humor, but you know where I got a sense of humor? I'm drifting now. You'll have to forgive me. Do you know where I got my sense of humor, if you're interested at all? Look, the art of conversation, as I learned when I was 18 years old, is to converse. It's not to win an argument. I could have political arguments and win all day long. It's not going to make you happier, nor is it going to make me happier. The art of conversation, you should remember with your friends, even if you live in New York and you're a bigoted liberal, the art of conversation is to converse. It's to keep the conversation going. It's not to beat the other guy. Don't be a lawyer with everybody you meet. Or worse yet, don't be a talk show host. You know what I mean? Conversing means sharing verse. Originally, it was a man who got up and read his verse to the other man, and the other man then shared his verse. Conversation. Look at the origin of that word I just gave you, conversation. But we are so didactic in this nation, and English is such a difficult language for conversation, that I'm sorry, we all revert back to some legalistic notion of what a conversation should be. Now, I realize this is not a course in conversation. It's in barking. It is a conversation about barking, which Teddy understands better than I do. Teddy, shut up. You're interrupting a very important radio show. Stop it. 1-800-449-8255. Duncan in Ogden, Utah, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
I absolutely love your chapter in Trickle Up Poverty on voter fraud.
I'm sure that 100,000 people have finally read that chapter and realized what's going on.
Yeah, you know, the neatest thing is I've tracked elections through time, and I actually have 2 degrees that focused on elections. But, you know, the 24th Amendment and other voting rights legislation that got rid of poll taxes and literacy tests in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, what you've pointed out in your chapter is now we've proliferated all these new forms of voter fraud with the new Black Panther Party and Acorn and so forth.
Well, that's how dictatorships are built, are on voter fraud. That's how Chavez stole Venezuela from the middle class, is through voter fraud. Look, I'm very clear in what I believe. I believe anyone on welfare should not have the right to vote while they're collecting public assistance. Why do I say that? Because they've abrogated their responsibility to society, either through bad luck or through bad actions. If they get back on their feet, they get the right to vote. If they're collecting a government check on welfare, they don't vote. Because otherwise, they're going to be constantly voting themselves a raise, and we're going to be twisting further towards socialism. It's common sense, is it not?
It is, right. And I think what's neat is about your chapter there is that I think it helped in this election because people were focused on what those potential areas of voter fraud were, and they weren't as successful as those that tried to propagate them thought they would be. So I think
sound like a very literate man, and you know that the book is a serious book. And I hope people look at the weeds creeping into the garden of the society. The weeds have crept into the garden of democracy. They're taking over the neighborhoods one by one. And most people are sitting there smiling up at the sun, waiting for the raindrops to fall, not knowing that very soon the weeds will overtake them and they too will cease to exist. And America is that garden. I mean, that is beautiful, and I wrote it. It's on page 298, and I thank you for noticing it. I want to read you a paragraph. I didn't mean to. It's from Albert Einstein, one line. Chapter 11. The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it. Albert Einstein. Shall I read that again? The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it. Albert Einstein. And then Dr. Savage writes, the future of America hangs in the balance like a loose tooth. The more you look at America's problems, the more it looks like Lady Liberty is suffering from terminal cancer. Patriots like you and me are oncologists. Every limb of the body politic that we explore, we see that the cancer has spread. Is that an overstatement? Far from it. Name one organ of government that isn't infected with this mad progressivism, mad Marxism, and mad pacifism that I've dissected in this book. Now more than at any other time in our history, we're in danger of losing our freedom and our national identity to the gang of Marxist thugs who have taken over our government. This administration will stop at nothing to exert total control over every aspect of our lives. It promises to sentence all of us to life without parole in the cradle-to-grave prison that is Marxism. You want me to keep firing away? Because I will. Here's a speech you should be hearing in Congress late night on C-SPAN instead of that rubbish that you hear. This is what you want to hear coming out of the mouths of our congresspeople. You want to hear fire-breathing dragons, not newts, who are going to get along and go along. Yes, Lady Liberty has been poisoned with this cancer, the cancerous toxins of liberalism. Left unchecked, her voice will be silenced, and her shining beacon of hope and freedom will be forever extinguished. And while the country that our forefathers fought and died for may be hanging in the balance, that doesn't necessarily mean America is destined to go out with a whimper. Can America be saved? So then I write about it. Now, I want to take a hiatus from what I just read. When I started the show, I was in a kind of lyrical mood, and I was joking about curry. And I know many people love when I get into these tangents, and it's fun. It's easier on my chest, easier on my heart. I got to be honest with you. Slogging towards this election, promoting my book and telling you what's in it, it was hard work. It really was hard work. But it was a fight that had to be fought. But I got to tell you something. The fight is just beginning. Obama's not going to compromise. The fanatic mad dog liberals are even getting more vicious, if you notice them on television. They're telling him to get even more malicious and more dictatorial. So don't give up just because you think you won. And I'll tell you your greatest threat. Your greatest threat are the Republicans who are now back in power, because they're going to disappoint you unless you keep the pressure on them. I'm warning you. They're not all like Colonel West. I'm telling you, they're not all like Colonel West. He's a true patriot. That man I would trust with my life. How do you like that? And I never met him. How do you like that? Why? Because he risked his life for this country. That's how I know it. Okay? It's as simple as that. I'm a very simple, basic man. I trust him. I don't have any reason to trust the others who came in on the coattails of the Tea Party movement. But let me go back a little further. So I was having fun joking about the curry and the this and the cars and the friend with the post office, right? And many of you who don't like my politics but love me, my shtick or my stories, in other words, you like me personally but you hate my politics. All right, I understand. Then you get a shocked when I tell you the politics, and I'm so hard about it and so right. You get shocked. It scares you. Now, I would imagine many of you liberals who are like that, who like me but don't like my politics, are very much like the artists who I used to know very well, who are all aping the real artists, like Orson Welles, for example. So sometimes I imagine that it's suddenly the 1940s or 50s, and my friends are people such as, and of course I'm going to lump them all in the same decade, even though some of them were no longer around. And my personal friends would be Orson Welles, Pablo Picasso, and people of that mental level, okay? Iconoclastic, totally cynical about politics, etc., and virtually all of them were not patriotic. In fact, most of them were communists. Almost every one of them was a red through and through, which is shocking when you think about it, because an artist cannot function in a communist dictatorship. Of all people, artists should understand that they cannot function in a dictatorship either of the left or of the right. How they don't understand this is bewildering to me. So I would think that, let us say after the show, I would go to a cafe with Picasso and Orson Welles, and they'd say to me, hey, Savage, you know, ease up a bit, man, with that hokey right-wing crap. Come on, you don't really mean it, do you? I said, all right, you know, believe what you want to believe. Why is patriotism mutually exclusive from humor? I would ask them. And why is love of country mutually exclusive with a love of literacy or a love of art or whatever you want to call it? I don't understand why they're mutually exclusive, why they can't go hand in hand. I have only a few people I would call my friends, and one of them is a PhD scientist who is also an iconoclast. I know him for years, but we never were political together. We only got to know each other politically recently. He loves my writings, loved my books, blah, blah, blah. You would think by nature he and I would both be hanging around with liberals, right? But we don't. Then when we got to know each other, something odd came up. Although I grew up in the Bronx and he grew up in Brooklyn and we didn't know each other, this is almost shocking. It turned out that both he and I were given awards when we were little kids in grade school for art. My art was of George Washington crossing, I think, the Delaware. I actually think it was the Trenton River. In that great painting of Washington crossing the river on the rowboat, I got so enraptured with that picture that I drew it, and I drew it, and I drew it. To this day, I can remember drawing the blue waves. I got, you know, would you ever do art? I got so caught up in the blue and the swirl of the water, and I kept creating the swirls over and over and over. And before I knew it, I had painted what was a pretty good little picture. I don't know where it is today. And the teacher said, wow, that's good. And so then she took me all over the elementary school with the picture. Here's Michael's picture of George Washington crossing, I think, the Delaware. Okay, it was the best picture I ever made. I wish I knew where it was. I think it got thrown out or whatever. So I just jokingly told my friend about it 2 weeks ago. He almost fell down. He said, are you kidding? He said, I used to draw pictures when I was a kid in Brooklyn of Revolutionary War heroes, and I was taken around my school for that. I said, are you kidding me? We're like blood brothers, but here's the bigger story. Mrs. S. was smarter than the two of us. She said, guys, think about this. She said, your teachers taught you patriotism in the first and second grade when you were children. They taught you what America was in the first and second grade when you were children. They extolled the beauty of America in the first and second grade when you were children. Now compare it to the crop of teachers that we have today. Compare it to the NEA that we have today. Compare it to NPR that we have today. All of these groups teach anti-Americanism, hate America, hate the family, hate the military, hate the police, hate normalcy. Bring it all down, girl. I'll be back, kids.
Clear that the voters send a message, which is they want us to focus on the economy and jobs and moving this country forward. They're concerned about making sure that taxpayer money is not wasted.
Which is why we are going to India on Saturday and bringing 42 warships and as many airplanes and spending $200 million a day as we can. Moreover, I want to tell you this. We learned nothing from the election. And the minute you go back to sleep, we'll push forward the Communist Manifesto. That's all. New York City, WOR. Ari, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, it's truly an honor to be talking to you. I just want to respectfully disagree with something that you said a couple of weeks ago. You said that a lot of your readers love reading your books because they heard your voice when reading it. I love reading your books because I didn't hear your voice. I just heard the genius behind the solid point that you bring, and I love the fact that you have so much passion. I listen to you every day on the way back from work to home, which I have a long 2-hour ride. But
wow.
I love the fact that the book, it was so clear. It was so, he's right. You know, everything that he's saying is perfectly clear to me, and it really opened up my eyes more so than what I had before in terms of knowledge of what the Democrats
are. Ari, what age bracket are you in?
I am a 27-year-old.
Right. Well, it's not easy to know how to navigate through all of the rhetoric. And Justice Saul Alinsky wrote Rules for Radicals. You might say I wrote the Rules for the Anti-Radicals. How's that? Does that work for you?
Well, That works for me. I just want to let you know that you have, I'm an Orthodox Jew, and you have a very big, loyal crowd listening to you every day.
You may be the first Orthodox Jew who spent the money to buy my book, Symbol Shot, joking. No, no, you know, there's a guy in the media who's very big in a certain church. They all buy his book, which is why it sells so many. I've never called up the heads of Jewish organizations and said, why don't you tell the people it's kosher and they should buy my book?
Listen,
and why don't they do that at 777 Eastern Parkway? Tell everyone to buy my book.
I'm not in that part of town. I actually grew up in a different part of Brooklyn, but I told all
is it hard to be religious?
I find it. I I've had my ups and downs in life, and I've had the points where I maybe question religion, but it's always been there for me.
No one's ever asked that question. Is it hard to be religious? I think it's a great question. I have never become very religious. I have always believed in God, but it's very difficult for me to become religious and practice religion, so to speak. And I often wonder how people who are very intelligent, and I know some who are also very orthodox in their practices, whether they be fundamentalist Christians or Orthodox Jews, I don't know how they do it and then function in a rational world. You know what I'm saying? Because it's almost two different universes.
I feel that you have to be asking questions. Like, I feel that some people are just religious because maybe that's what they learned or it became like.
All right, we can do this on Friday when I do Religionary. I'm going to send you a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty for your personal use. And also, call us tomorrow when we do religion. I'm going to ask that question. Is it tough to be religious? Thank you. Really appreciate it. That's a... Boy, the mind is working again. What a shame in a mind like mine.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Playing music sure to rankle anti-American communists. So if you find the jingoistic music that you're hearing offensive, you are by definition a communist. Play a little bit more. I want to agitate everyone in New York. If you love America, roll your window down and play a little of this music and my mellifluous voice to go with it. Because really, it's a new beginning. Thank God it's Thursday already. That's all I can say. And here we go into the second round of the Savage Nation. So, Senator, I was asked today by somebody in the conservative media in an interview who I would select to run against Obama in the next election. I cannot play this game, but I said them in. If they run Huckabee, they're finished. Obama will be president a second term. I'm telling you right now, I can see it better than anybody. Huckabee's unelectable. That's all there is to it. His name alone should tell you all you need to know about him. Symbol shot. You got to understand that it's not that he's a bad man, but he's unelectable. There are certain things that determine whether or not a person can sell or not. And a few of them have to do with hair. I've analyzed this going back to George Washington. And it's usually he who has more hair that wins in almost every election, which indicates that in the next election, it's probably going to be a woman. Because there's going to be hair on both sides of the aisle, and it's going to be flying, symbol shot. So therefore, I believe that it'll be Hillary Clinton in the primary beating Obama, because they know he's been a disaster for the Democrat Party. I think that's pretty much a given. Hillary Clinton is now going to face the Republicans. You want to do this now, 18 years ahead of it? I can't do this. But for God's sakes, don't say Huckabee and don't say Romney to me. They're not electable. Why? In the case of Romney, he said nothing now for 2 years. He has been invisible, not there, doesn't support any of the Tea Party movement. He's a Boston liberal. I mean, how many different ways can I tell you he's unelectable? He's personally a wonderful man. I admire him very much. I have nothing but good things to say about him. I had dinner with him alone, me and him, last December. I like the man very much. I respect him and his family. He can't win. He can't win because Romney care is equal to Obamacare, and all of his politics are that of mainline liberalism. That's number one. Now, don't bring up the Mormonism because I like Mormons. I've always worked with Mormons very well, and I respect them very much. But you've got to understand there's a tremendous disparity between Mormons and mainline Christians in many quarters. There's a huge problem there. And if you don't understand it, I don't want to get into it right now, but it's there. That's number one. So people said to me, well, who would you think could beat Hillary Clinton? I said, Jim DeMint. I said, people don't even know him yet. Now, I said this 6 months ago, a year ago, when before you heard of Jim DeMint. I've been admiring this senator a long time. And they said, well, what do you admire about Senator Jim DeMint? I said, A, his politics, B, his politics, and C, his politics. This man is the real stuff. He's a gentleman, and he's a real conservative without being jingoistic or extreme. And he has a way about him. He's been on this show. His voice is very calming. He has a distinct southern gentleman projection. The type of man that you would follow in combat. You know, I always judge people, men, when you say leadership, to a great extent by their ability to marshal your... leadership means when you lead them. When you follow their lead. What does leadership mean? It means a man who inspires you to want to follow them, doesn't it? So, A, it has to be a voice and a projection of that voice. And if the voice projects a desire in you to follow them, that's leadership. If the voice doesn't project that, then he's not a leader. Obviously, Obama had a leadership voice. He has a beautiful voice. Make no mistake about it. The man is the Pied Piper. That's how he got so far with no credentials. How else do you think a man who has absolutely no abilities whatsoever to be a president, who did nothing in his life to qualify him for the presidency, in fact, did the opposite, how did he become president? Because he has leadership qualities. Don't take that away from him. He has a basso voice. It's fabulous. As a man who knows voices, one of the best voices ever. And this came after 8 years of a mangler. If you remember the jokes about poor Bush. Dyslexia, I mean, it's nothing to laugh at. But you wouldn't expect somebody to go to the presidency who couldn't finish a sentence. Do you remember all of those gaffes? It wasn't funny after a while. It was embarrassing. So along came a literate man with a great voice, and that was it, and he got elected. So now apply that theory that I have presented to you to the realm of politics out there. And you can start to see, if you combine hair with voice, you can pretty much predict who the next president will be. Teddy could win based on that hair and voice. Based on that theorem, my dog could probably run and get 15% of the popular vote. He's got a lot of hair and a tremendous bark. Oh, goodness. So the government decided today... The schmuck, what's his name, Bernanke? What idiots. Geithner is such a putz, he couldn't even sell his own house. Now, that, to me, that gave everything away. The guy had a house on Long Island. When he took the job in Washington, he couldn't sell the house. He had to borrow money to live in his uncle's apartment. The guy's running a trillion-dollar economy. Doesn't he look like a schmendrick to you, the Treasury Secretary? He looks like an office boy who's told what to do. And yet here he is running the economy. So it turns out that he actually asked the comedian, the same schmuck who doesn't know what to say to get a joke unless his writers write him lines. He visited him in New York at Comedy Central and asked the comedian what he should do about the economy. This shows you who's running the country today. You know, he should have asked someone in talk radio who knows something about the economy what we should do about the economy. Because I tell you, I have plans on how to save the economy. You know, don't assume that all of this is just showmanship. At the end of the day, I understand business as well as the next man. And I understand it in the traditional way. I grew up in a family where my father didn't take any loans. He did not buy anything he couldn't afford. He didn't believe in paying for anything he couldn't afford. He thought it was cheating. To give you some idea of the kind of household I grew up in, I used to say, Dad, why don't you buy a new car? They have this newfangled thing called buying it on time. I wouldn't do that. I'd rather be caught dead. That's cheating. What do they have? Kool-Aid kid in there with that new car. He would always buy like a used Cadillac 3 years old because he owned it, and he felt it was what he could afford. Now you say, well, that's silly. By that definition, nobody would own anything. Well, all right, I understand that. I agree with you. I think credit is wonderful. But there's a point at which credit becomes quite tricky, isn't it? When you start printing money, you're no longer buying things on time that you could ultimately afford to pay for. So the government has run out of the ability to pay their payment book, in other words, that they're printing a payment book into like the year 3095 in order to pay off the so-called entitlements today. Cut the entitlements. So they won't go to Atlantic City as frequently. That's all. Cut the entitlements. So they won't go and gamble with a cigarette hanging out of their mouth with an oxygen tank and a transfusion tree dragging around the casino. So what? Isn't that embarrassing that people work their whole lives to go to Disneyland and Atlantic City? I don't understand that. That's what a retiree lives for, the day that they can go to Atlantic City and Disneyland with their grandchildren? I went to Disneyland once in my entire life when the children were young, and I had to take a sedative. I swear to God, I'm willing to admit it. I couldn't get through it. I don't like amusement parks to begin with. I've told you that before. Like, crowds to begin with freak me out. Unless I'm performing, I'm not afraid of crowds. I love crowds when I can control them. I suppose that's why I'm a great performer, because I do like crowds that I can control. But the thought of being a face in the crowd is actually a frightening thing to me. I feel like I'm drowning. Isn't that amazing? So I don't like big cities anymore. Even though I grew up in one, I get dizzy in a big crowd. I think it's an interesting psychological thing I just told you. But to get back to the payment book that I was talking about, which was a better idea for you, the government has a payment book, right, for the economy, and they're now printing a new payment book that goes forward so many years into the future that who do you think is going to be paying that payment book? Your children's children, which is what this election was about. Now, let me go back to crowds and audiences for a minute, because I was onto something and I forgot where I was going. Phil, where was I heading? Do you recall anything I said? Phil went to sleep, okay? I've been up all night, I swear to God. It's one of those weird nights where I thought I couldn't even go on the air today. I got mad. You know, I did a show at 7 in the morning, which for me is frightening. Then another at 10, then 11. I'm not used to this. Then the Indian buffet. And I went back to sleep and couldn't sleep. And here it is. I have more energy than ever. The thing is, though, is that you know when you're not functioning perfectly is when your memory starts to jump. And right now, truly, it's not like I have any trouble with memory. I never do. But because of the exhaustion of the last 6, 7, 8, 10 weeks of the book and the election, my mind is a little on the memory side. I could just feel it's not firing as fast as it normally does, where I can make up jokes on the spot, create beautiful ideas, paint pictures with my words, incredible energy, and also have a great memory for almost all the facts and figures I want to remember. I really found it lacking just for one second. You'll have to forgive me. I don't know what my name is, nor do I know why I'm standing here with a microphone in my hand. Where am I, guys? Where exactly? What are we doing here? Right. Daisy, Daisy. Daisy, Daisy, my name is Hal. You remember that? That was one of the most startling scenes in the history of the movie. Do you remember that? Kubrick's 2000, and, was it 2001? Imagine how long ago that was. 2001. That was interesting. Wait a minute. Didn't we get hit on 9/11? But like 2001, right? Yeah, it was interesting. Anyway, but I remember when I first saw that movie, like 1970, I saw it in the Cinerama Theater in Honolulu. I couldn't believe that movie. You know that movie, 2001, when I saw it, I actually worked for my PhD because of that movie. I realized that he was projecting a future where all of the people who ran the world all had higher degrees. Do you know that? Of course, he wasn't correct. Take a look at who's on Fox News, symbol shot. But having said that, the fact is, the movie was quite influential. But do you remember when the HAL 2000, when he gets into the computer's brain and starts taking apart the memory chips and the computer talks to him? It was so eerie. It was so eerie. You know what I'm saying? The idea of your brain melting down like that was terrifying. And for a brief period in my professional career, I worked in Alzheimer's research. It is really frightening to see a human being disintegrate from that part down. It's frightening to see. I had a friend of the family whose dad was one of the great pilots of the Vietnam War. 200 combat missions. Okay, I don't want to go into details. It's one of the most tragic of all diseases. It probably is the most tragic of all diseases. It's one thing to have a disease where your body is dying, but your mind is still alert. It's another thing to have your body, you know, fall apart, which eventually happens to all of us. And it's a third, another thing to not know who you are, not know who your children are. I mean, it's a horrible curse. It's been described as losing your soul. You understand that? Now, there's no metaphor here. I could make 30 metaphors if I wish to. But all I can tell you is that it's as though to me that Bernanke and Geithner are men who have somewhat of a psychic Alzheimer's disease. How could they not understand that by printing money, they're not diminishing the value of the dollar? Everyone who understands this knows that they're going to diminish the value of the dollar by 10 to 20%. They don't know that? No, I think a guy who can't sell his house in Laurelton wouldn't know that. I'll be right back.
Savage.
We have a real treat for you out of the archives. We have secured perhaps the first copy of a tape of our Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, overheard whispering on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Listen to this.
I honestly think you ought to sit down calmly, take a stress pill, and think things over.
Daisy. Daisy. Give me your answer, too. I'm half crazy. All for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage.
You're listening to the sound of the Treasury Secretary as he prints more money. He has no idea what he is doing or what he's printing. It sounds like the sound of the Obama administration, actually. It sounds like it, doesn't it? I mean, the overall administration sounds like that when you think about it. Let's hope so. Houston, Texas. Pete, you're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, pleasure to talk to you, sir.
Thank you.
Well, sir, I just want to give you a quick TUP story. Took your advice, took my copy of TUP into the polling place, and had it tucked neatly under my arm. After the first few looks and sneers that I got from a few people on the line, I proceeded to open it up to your Obamacare chapter where I'd left off, page 221. And as I was reading it in line, I had the sensation of someone behind me with the combination of halitosis and garlic rolling over my left shoulder. As I moved up a few feet in the line and started to turn around, I noticed this older gentleman was none other than a independent school district police officer. Looked him square in the eye, and he gave me a wink and went, oof, as he was looking over my shoulder.
So he was looking at the book?
He was looking at the book over my shoulder.
So the policeman had garlic breath while he was reading my book over your shoulder?
Yeah, he must have hit the pizza parlor before he showed up to throw his vote in.
But did he like the book, or he was winking because he liked it or didn't like it?
I got the impression he liked it. He gave me a wink and went, oof, we were reading about it.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to send you another copy of Trickle Up Poverty. If you can find, be on the lookout for a policeman. How tall was he?
Oh, he was probably 5'10".
5'10", was he Caucasian?
Yes, he was, and very large.
All right, everyone in Houston, Texas, if you can see a policeman in uniform, 5'10", with garlic breath, would you please be on the lookout for him, because Pete is about to give him a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty. Pete, stay on the line. I'm in a giddy mood. White House calls Brian Williams after he questions the mail bomb terrorist threat. Did you hear this story? You're not going to believe it. The White House basically threatened NBC because Williams thought that the bombing was hokum. You know, a little on the hokum side for all the hoopla.
Savage.
So to get down to brass tacks, we really have to ask ourselves, will the Republican Congress follow the Tea Party ideas, Or are they going to move to the center after giving everyone the BS? My guess is that the GOP's congressional leadership will pretend that they're going to the right, but they're going to legislate closer to the center. It's not what I'd like to see done. It's what George Bush did. He humored the right-wing base while expanding the government. And that's exactly what I'm afraid is liable to happen again. Now, Newt Gingrich, to his credit in the beginning, put out the contract with America, and they tried to pass some real serious controls. They wanted to slash federal spending on Medicare, Medicaid, education, and the environment. And that was what should have been done. But they eventually rolled over to Bill Clinton. So I'm praying that the new crop of Tea Party candidates, under the leadership of Jim DeMint in the Senate, where, of course, there aren't that many newcomers, I hope that they follow the mandate of those who put them in office and they don't forget who put them in office is all I pray for. Now, whether or not that will happen, I don't know. Yesterday we had on Congressman Alan West, and I believe he is going to be, frankly, a guy I can believe will do what he was put there to do. As for the others, I don't know if they're as literal-minded about why they were put in office as I would like to believe. Now, Senator DeMint put out a speech today. Actually, it's an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, and he offered a 5-point prescription for newly elected conservatives. One, no earmarks. If you play the game, they own you. Two, hire conservative staff. Don't get undermined from within. Don't be seduced by committee assignments. Don't seek titles in the hierarchy, and doing your job takes priority over being reelected to do your job. So I hope to God that people remember this. The number 6 is the most important, where he says, remember, it is an assignment, not a career. The minute you start to think about what you could accomplish in your next term, you're no longer of any use to the country. Now, that's good. Those are good rules. Very good rules. I have 37 points. English only, close the borders, defend the borders, defund Obamacare, reduce the size of government. And actually, I'm very specific on that. I'm going to stop there. On page 303 of Trickle Up Poverty, I have distinct plans for reducing the size and scope of government. And right now, we have a wonderful congressperson, Michelle Bachmann, joining us on the Savage Nation. Congresswoman, thank you for being on the Savage Nation.
It's wonderful to be with such a terrific talk show host. Thank you for letting me be on today.
I have a question for you. You went on a fellow show on CNN yesterday who, tried to debase the Tea Party movement when it just began. He made the sneered at you yesterday, and he said, what do you mean $200 million a day to go to India? And he said, where do you get that data from? Well, you got it from where we all got it from, the Indian government itself. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's the same material that's been out in the press that everyone's been reading. And I almost wondered if the White House was monitoring it and trying to feed questions to Anderson Cooper. He couldn't do enough to protect the president. And yet here the president has a fleet of battleships. He has at least 40 jumbo planes. He has over 800 hotel rooms at a 5-star Taj Mahal Palace hotel. Over 2,000 people are going with him on this trip, and the number that we read was $200 million a day. I mean, for heaven's sakes, if it's that kind of a complicated problem, use video conferencing.
Yeah, why go there? The man gives a speech, the president, saying that he understands that the people said cut back on spending and he's sensitive to it. Why not just cancel the trip? Not only is it an abomination financially, but it's actually, if it's such a high security risk, why go? What's this all about, Congresswoman?
Well, right. The thing is, we don't want our president to be put in a place where there's going to be a terrible danger for him. And no one begrudges him a security detail. That's not
no.
it. But we have never seen this level of excess before. Flying personal chefs all over, personal chefs going with him on this trip. We've just never seen this kind of excess. This even exceeds Mrs. Obama's trip to Spain this summer and all the vacations, one after another.
No, it's an embarrassment. And I don't understand how the Democrats don't see the embarrassment. 34 warships to India, removing coconuts from trees on his path. Did you read the latest report, Congresswoman? The U.S. military is going to build a kilometer-long bomb-proof tunnel so Obama can go to the Gandhi Museum. This is crazy.
Oh, I
and $200 million dollars a day is astounding. I have a question for you, Congresswoman Bachman, and that's this. Do you remember when you first appeared on this show, The Savage Nation, and you said to my audience that you were the number one target of Nancy Pelosi? Do you remember that interview? I do. You know, I actually thought that they might, you know, because Pelosi went after you tooth and fang. And take a guess who's laughing now. It looks like she's going back to cannoli making and you're going to Congress.
Well, it isn't for lack of trying, because Michael, my opponent was the best funded challenger in the country. And we had President Obama, Vice President Biden, Speaker Pelosi, President Clinton twice, all sorts of Democrat luminaries. All of them came in to our state and campaigned against me. I don't know if anyone had that kind of firepower aimed against them, and we prevailed, and I'm thrilled that we prevailed. And now Speaker Pelosi may be on her way home to San Francisco.
But, Congresswoman, I want to remind my audience that they helped. Didn't they send some funds in the beginning? And I just want to thank them, because I know many of the listeners probably heard that show. They knew you were the underdog. They knew Pelosi had targeted you. And they knew they were doing it because you were such a firebrand, true Tea Party, right-wing, conservative, if you can use all those terms. I'm not ashamed to use them. And forgive me if you are, but the fact is that I think my audience came to bat for you, didn't they?
They absolutely did. And not only did they come to bat for me, you came to bat for me. And I can't thank you, and I can't thank your generous audience enough for what they did. They made all the difference in the world very early on, exactly when I needed the help, because the Democrats started running TV ads against me in July. That's how bad this was. And if I wouldn't have had that help from you and your audience early on to let Speaker Pelosi know that I'm in this for real, and I'm going to take her on at every level, I don't know that we would have been able to prevail, because money coming in later would have helped. I needed it exactly when your listeners sent it. They're extremely generous, and I can't thank them enough.
Right, and that's really the reason I asked you in the midst of this busy schedule to come on the show. The people really needed to hear that from you, because, you know, they don't have any people who say thank you to them, but they did send money. And they love an underdog, and we're so happy that you beat the biggest odds, truthfully. And we wish you the best of luck in your struggles. I mean, the big struggle now for all of us who voted for people such as yourself, Congresswoman Bachman, and for the others, is whether or not the Republicans are going to, let's say, mollify the base while, ruling to the center. That's what I'm afraid of, is that they're going to do gestures and symbols, mollify the Tea Party base without taking any of its ideology seriously. And that's the frightening part here.
Well, and let me announce to your audience right now, I threw my hat in the ring to run for leadership for exactly that reason. I want to make sure that this extraordinary movement, like nothing we have seen in modern times, that's risen up just in this last year or so, I want to make sure that that pulse actually has a seat at the leadership table. So I'm running for GOP conference chair. It's an important leadership position, and I need help. I need your listeners' help. I need to have
How do they influence that selection?
Well, the way that it works to make sure that we have a voice at leadership is they need calls to their local member of Congress, and they need to tell their local member, look, if they're a Republican, if they're a Democrat, it won't matter. If they call a Republican and tell them, look, Michelle Bachman is one of us. I think she's going to continue to stand for what we believe in. I want you to vote for her and put her in leadership. And I think if the members of Congress hear that message, they'll give that vote, because, yes, there is a traditional establishment-based club that exists, and I frankly think we need some new blood, new ideas that represent these great people that actually gave the majority. This wasn't a Republican majority. This was a constitutional conservative majority, and I think certainly there should be at least one seat at the table for the people that did all this work.
Yeah, I pray to God that happens, and I hope my audience heeds your words very seriously, as I'm pretty sure many of them will. And Congresswoman Bachman, first I want to congratulate you on winning this tremendous fight. And also I want to send you a few copies of Trickle Up Poverty for yourself and the others, the new blood, the rebels, if you want to put it that way, so they can see, you know, this book has become a bestseller very rapidly, not because I'm such a brilliant writer, but because the message in that book is what the American people believe in and want to see transferred into Washington. Can we please send you a whole bunch of these books to give out to others who may be like-minded in Congress?
I absolutely will. And, Michael, I'm starting a new caucus, the Constitutional Conservative Caucus, where every week we're holding classes on the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights. I'm going to invite in Justice Scalia and Thomas and Alito and legal experts that understand the Constitution to come in and teach it. I will give every one of those members your book and let them know how important it is to be able to take to look at this and hear how important this message is.
Well, I don't want to go on and on about my book, but the truth is a lot of people took this book into the voting booth with them, and they really created quite a stir. I get reports from around the country how many people had it online with them. It's taken America by storm, and I only hope that some people in Congress read this book and take it seriously. But Congresswoman Bachman, you've got bigger things to do right now than to chat with me about my book. What's next on your agenda?
Well, this is the next thing. I'm running for GOP conference chair, so I'm in the middle of calling all of the members of Congress right now, asking for their support to give me to put me into this position so that I can take this message into the leadership and go forward. So I'm working on that, and we'll meet in Washington, D.C. the week after next, and we'll take the election for this vote. So it's going to happen very soon.
Here's the last question. You are a tax attorney by profession, correct?
I am. Yes, I am.
I remember that. I have a memory like an elephant. I'm very impressed with that. It's a very tough aspect of the law. What is the likelihood that the tax raises that Obama has desired will be nullified? Will we see a continuation of the Bush tax cuts? What do you think?
I think that we will if Republicans fight. If we fight and say that we will not agree to raising anyone's taxes, then I think we'll be able to get it through. But here's the sad story. Speaker Pelosi adjourned and allowed every taxpaying American's taxes to go up 1 second after midnight, some of the largest tax increases in American history. So we're going to have an agreement, and I don't see...
Wait. When did she do this?
When she adjourned about, what was it, a month ago, when she adjourned Congress...
Oh.
Adjourned, knowing that every tax today is going to expire because they did not expire.
Wait a minute, you mean that she adjourned a month ago knowing that they were going to lose? You think she knew?
No, I think she adjourned because Senator Feinstein, your California senator, she let the cat out of the bag. She said we cannot vote on taxes before an election. So she told really all Americans that they were gutless and unwilling to take this vote because they knew Speaker Pelosi thought they'd come back, she would still have the gavel, and she thought then they would raise taxes. Now, after the election, she was planning to make sure that they only let a few people keep the current tax rate. Otherwise, she was going to jack everybody else's taxes up. But today, everyone's taxes in the United States are going to be jacked up. Everyone's. And what we need to do is...
How do you explain to the average listener how two of the richest women in the world or in the Congress, Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein, are in favor of increasing taxes for the rich? How does that make sense?
Well, it doesn't. That's why I think they had their rear ends handed to them and they were shown to the door, because the people don't want their taxes increased. That's what the tax party stood for. The Tea Party. They stood for government not spending more money than what they take in, don't raise anyone's taxes, and act within the Constitution. That's it. That's all they stood for. So Speaker Pelosi and Senator Feinstein are completely the opposite. They want to raise people's taxes, especially people making over $200,000 a year. And, of course, that means small businesses. And
right.
That means massive job losses. So if you,
absolutely.
If you want to add to unemployment, you'd go with the current plan that Speaker Pelosi has. Well, unfortunately, like I said, the fact is every tax-paying American's taxes are scheduled to go up. Even people at the lowest income level, their taxes are going up. Unless we go back into Congress and we say, nope, we're going to keep the current tax rates we have now, we're going to extend them. But Barack Obama is not indicating he is going to be flexible at all and agree with the Republicans. I don't think he learned any lesson from Tuesday night. I hope he did.
Oh, no, he's going to India for $200 million a day. What does that tell us? Go watch what the man does, not what he says. And that's why trickle-up poverty is prescient in the sense that he and the U.S. Federal Reserve deciding to print an extra $600 billion, in other words, print money, that is going to impoverish everyone listening to this program. It's not straightening things out. It's making it worse. I know you're about to get on an airplane. Congresswoman Bachman needs your help. I want everyone listening to the show to contact the new Congress and support her in her desires to get into a leadership position. Thank you very much, Congresswoman, for being with us on the Savage Nation. We'll send you a copy of Trickle Up Poverty. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Look, this is very serious stuff. I mean, you got a world laden with nuclear weapons. You've got mad fanatics who believe they're going to their heaven if they kill others of another religion. And I really don't know that any president can placate these fanatics, truthfully. And if they're not willing to use the maximum military force against them, I'm afraid we're in real trouble. But I've said all of that before. So having put that as a background, I have to ask myself as a concerned citizen, why the president would spend so much money bringing in warships, digging tunnels, denuding coconut trees, $200 million a day. Why? What is so urgent about going to India? We hear it's about trade, but I don't believe it. They're occupying every room in the Taj Hotel. Why? Wouldn't a logical conclusion be that there are going to be some high-level meetings with individuals that they don't want anyone to know or are there? And I'll leave it at that. I mean, this is not a show about conspiracy. It's make-believe I'm writing a novel. If I were a novelist, I mean, I'm asking a question that anyone with intelligence would ask. Why $200 million a day? Why such horrible security precautions? If it's so dangerous, I pray to God he doesn't go. I may not like his politics, but he's my president. It's my country, too. It would be a disaster if, God forbid, something went wrong there. I'd rather he not go. So what's the imperative, I ask myself. See, there must be something more than just meeting with a few manufacturers and bringing a few American businessmen. Of course there are businessmen going. We read the private business jets are flying in along with Air Force 1, 2, and probably 2.5. But the question is, why 34 warships? Who is he meeting with, and what's this about? I don't know, but I wish him the best. I pray to God he didn't have to go. I mean, we do have a thing called email today and teleconferencing. Why can't business be done by email and teleconferencing? What's the travel for? I don't go on business trips unless it's imperative. When I was told when I was young, the only reason to travel is for weddings and for funerals. Other than that, I don't travel if I can avoid it.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Listen up. our idiots running the U.S. economy are going to put billions, $600 billion worth of bonds, meaning they're going to print $600 billion of money. Okay, let's be clear. When you read that the U.S. Federal Reserve committed today to buy $600 billion of bonds with new money, what that means is they're going to inject $600 billion of printed money. Germany is shocked. German economy minister said he was concerned at U.S. efforts to stimulate growth by injecting liquidity into its struggling economy. This is actually very frightening, because the fact of the matter is this action of printing money forced gold to go up and other gold and other commodities to rise. Now, we claim that China is, playing with its currency. Beijing argues that U.S. monetary policy is also artificially influencing its currency. And I agree. I don't know where this ends. I have no idea where this ends, but if they're not willing to tighten their belt, if they're not willing to cut government, if they're not willing to cut spending, we're going to have a Weimar Republic, I think, and it's frightening. Now, what's interesting is that our president is leaving on a junket for India, as you well know, and he claimed he was chastened by the election. And yet, King Ludwig the Obama is going to spend $200 million a day, according to Indian sources now. He's taking 34 warships to India. Let me repeat that. Obama is taking 34 warships to protect them offshore in India. And coconuts have been removed from trees to protect Obama in India. Coconuts removed from trees. I think they should just use Agent Orange on the city and denude all the trees to protect them. And the U.S. military is going to build a 1-kilometer-long bomb-proof tunnel so the president or king can go see the Gandhi Museum. It's unbelievable to me. Now, the White House denies that the trip to India is going to cost $200 million a day, but it will not reveal the actual price tag. They're claiming for reasons of national security. Okay, 1-800-449-8255. Qantas jumbo jet, the biggest in the world, makes an emergency landing in Singapore after the engine explodes. Engine explodes. Frightening. San Francisco has banned the Happy Meal, and that's because you don't want happy children. What you want are depressed children so you can peddle them drugs and pay for it with Obamacare. Isn't that how Pelosi Care works? Ban the Happy Meal, make the children sad, put them on drugs, and therefore you can spend more of the people's money. Isn't that the way progressives work? A growing number of people are cutting down on showering and hair washing every day for the environment. I'll have no comment on that. I think all of them vote for Obama. That's how the French used to be in the 1950s. Remember the jokes about French hygiene and the lack of showers and no soap? I guess we're all becoming French now. Soon there'll be the garlic breath to go with it, the no showering, the no shampoo. I don't know, it might be more fun to live in a kind of more organic nation, don't you think, guys?
Oui, oui.
Please, this is a family show. We cannot mention body parts. And what else is out there? Barack has caused a meltdown in the Democrat Party. Well, what else? Let's see what else. The comedian who had a rally in Washington last weekend that very few attended, we learned today that our Treasury Secretary sought economic advice from him. Oh, my God. Kick out the clowns, as they say. Hillary Clinton is in New Guinea now. The prime minister referred to her as President Clinton. Do you think she's on a world tour to build up her national and international image, guys? I think so. Speaker-to-be vows to repeal Obamacare. Do you actually believe it? I hope so. I have a whole chapter on the attack on our medical system and trickle-up poverty. And look, you can argue all you want, but unless you know what's in it, you don't know what's in it. You want to know what's in it? I summarize it all in trickle-up poverty. Boehner vows to repeal Obama health care reforms. He said, I believe that the health care bill that was enacted by the current Congress will kill jobs in America, ruin the best healthcare system in the world, and bankrupt our country. That means we have to do everything we can to try to repeal this bill and replace it with common sense reforms to bring down the cost of health care. Well, I agree with him. I hope that he can, you know, pull it off. I just don't know how deeply entrenched the socialist special interests are. Kind of, that's a new one, socialist special interests. No one's used that yet. You know, they use special interests. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Let's go to Pauline in New York City. Welcome to the show, Pauline. What's on your mind, Pauline?
Your memory. I am in awe how much you recall items, dates, names, places. I mean, the way you jump from subject to subject. You talk about food.
Well, yes. In other words, today, if a kid had the abilities I have, they'd put him into a mental asylum because he would be too intelligent for this society. He'd be a threat to the civil order.
What do you attribute that to? I mean, inherited or vitamins?
That's very interesting. Well, hey, you know, that's a great question. Well, I don't know. My father was not a learned man. He was reasonably intelligent. He never went past the second year of high school. He was an immigrant. He didn't have the money or the time to go far in school, but he was very insightful and very analytical. I will say that. My mother was not an educated woman either. She was not well-read at all. She never really read a book. She had her own insights into human nature. She was a very good woman, and she lived through terrible tragedies. That made her stronger, I suppose. I think she gave me my sense of humor. I used to try to cheer her up when I was a little child, and I think that the ability to entertain came from the fact that I used to try and make my mother happy because she was so sad and crying over, you know, this thing in the house, and I used to try to make her happy. And when I would ask my mother, I said, Ma, if God came down, what would you ask God for? I mean, I was 4 years old. And she would say, well, I only want your brother to be well. I mean, now what does a little kid do with a thing like that? You know what I'm saying? So I don't know what the heck it is and what drove me in school and this and that. And I'm very curious about things, Pauline, to answer your question. I've always wanted to know what's behind the scene, you know, what's going on, how things work. You know what I'm saying? How to fix things. What makes a clock tick? It's the same with what makes a politician tick, which is why, and I'm sorry to have to say it again, I took Obama apart in trickle-up poverty, and I discovered there's a ticking Marxist inside of him. Do you have a copy yet of the book on where I prove that he's a lifetime Marxist?
Not yet, no.
And well, you have one right now. Stay in the line. The woman meant it. I didn't want to get into me again, but I'll be right back.
Savage.
We've been talking about the election and how the voice of the people have shouted out against Obama and his policies, just like I did in writing Trickle Up Poverty. And there's no doubt that the grassroots movements, such as the Tea Parties, have a lot to do with this major victory. Joining us now to listen to his viewpoint on this is Jack Hunter.
Good to be with you as always, Michael. Of course, the big story is that the American people, according to the midterm elections, have soundly rejected the big government policies of Barack Obama, Harry Reid, and Nancy Pelosi. Now, we're all disappointed that somebody like Harry Reid will still be in the Senate and lost that race. But that agenda has suffered a serious blow after what we saw last night with the Tea Party candidates rising to the top. Something's brewing out there, and I think the president's heard the message loud and clear.
Well, one of the messages that was sent was that the Tea Party was really for real.
There were a number of races, of course, which were of significance to conservatives like you or I and the Tea Partiers out there. But let's start with one of the most high profile, and that would have been Rand Paul's election to the U.S. Senate in Kentucky. Talk about a dirty race. Here's a guy who was the Tea Party candidate through and through, beat the Republican establishment in a primary in which you saw guys like Mitch McConnell and even former Vice President Dick Cheney coming out against Rand Paul, but the Tea Party prevailed. He won that race, and last night beat his Democratic opponent by a good 10-point solid margin. It was a wonderful night for the Tea Party. Rand Paul represents that sort of Barry Goldwater constitutional conservatism, to use his phrase, that the Tea Party is attracted to, the party of no. Yes, that's exactly what we are. We need to say no to runaway government. The liberal reaction to Rand Paul's election was particularly sort of amusing. I believe Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC said that if Rand Paul implements his policies, there would be a worldwide depression.
What?
So people were going crazy. The left was going crazy about the possibility of this hardcore conservative like Rand Paul, a Tea Partier in chief, said in New York Magazine, what's going to come of it. And rightfully so, because he is going to take them to task.
In the races such as that for Rand Paul and Alan West, a great deal of lies and mud was thrown at them, but they stayed on topic and they won those races.
Well, that's absolutely right, Michael. No matter how dirty it got, and as you point out, the dirtiest races, our guys, the Tea Partiers, the conservatives, came out on top. I just mentioned Rand Paul, and of course there's Alan West and others. It goes to show you that the people out there in the grassroots, the American public at large, are starting to see through the BS. They're seeing through the bull, quite frankly. Gutter politics and dirty politics has been around forever. But when people are concerned about a $13 trillion debt with a now $14 trillion debt ceiling enacted by the Democrats, things like Obamacare and TARP and all the spending they're seeing, that's what they're focusing on. They're not going to get caught up in the minutia of this dirty politics that we always see, and they care more about pocketbook issues. Who is representing them? The Tea Party candidate.
Well, this was clearly a statement against Obama and his agenda.
Absolutely. And we heard the president's speech in which, I guess, I wouldn't call he conceded as much. He'll never do that. But I think he's been made aware of exactly what's happened out there. People are rejecting Obama and the Democrats' agenda. There's no question about it. There's no way you can sort of put a pretty face on what happened with the midterm elections. It was a round rejection of what Obama stands for, his agenda, Obamacare, TARP, all the spending. You know, George W. Bush did double the size of national government. Americans were fed up with him. That's why they voted for Barack Obama. Well, now they're fed up with this president who is tripling the size of government. Things are out of hand, and I think Obama heard the message loud and clear in these elections.
How do we keep this on track?
The key is to keep the momentum going, to keep building momentum. The outrage out there at the grassroots right now that led to what happened in the midterm elections, which we've been discussing, needs to be sustained. Heading into 2012, looking at similar candidates to Rand Paul and Alan West and some of these other people, hopefully Joe Miller can pull it out there in Alaska after we figure out who actually wrote down Lisa Murkowski's name. but we just need to keep the momentum going. We can't forget, declare victory and this is great and wonderful. No, we're not even anywhere close to where we need to be. And just keep pushing in the right direction. I have every bit of faith that the Tea Party is going to do exactly that, and in the same bipartisan fashion that they've exhibited thus far. Republicans and Democrats, there's big government politicians in both those parties, and neither one of them will do. In primaries or general elections, they must go. We need real deal, true blue constitutional conservatives in office, and I think we're going to see that in 2012, and the Tea Party is going to have a lot to do with us getting there.
What can we expect to see in the next few years?
I think we're going to see the left even increasing their criticism that the Republicans are the party of no. And our reply to that should not be, oh, we're not obstruction. It should be, yes, we're the party of no. You can't spend any more money. We don't have any more money. Our children and grandchildren do not deserve this. How is it moral to spend money today to fix whatever problems we might have, and they never get fixed by spending more money? But let's say theoretically, even if they did, how is it moral to burden our children and the next generations with this massive amount of debt? It is completely immoral. So, yes, that's what we're going to see in the next few years. The Republicans are the party of no, and look at these extreme Tea Party candidates and politicians, and we just need to stand up and keep saying no and let them give as good as they can, and we'll keep taking it and keep saying no, and it's going to be a good thing in the end, quite frankly.
Well, with the success of the Tea Parties, are we seeing a shift in modern politics? I hope so.
I think we are seeing a shift in politics. You know, Scott Rasmussen of Rasmussen Polling, his data shows that not only is the Tea Party serious and can influence elections, as we saw, but that it's going to be an enduring movement. It's not going away anytime soon. This is something brand new in American politics. Have there been uprisings before? Some people compare the Tea Party to the Republican Revolution of 1994 and other similar movements. But nothing like this that has sustained. This has been around for a few years now. Not only is it showing its influence in things like the midterm elections, but it's growing. It's getting bigger. When polls show that more Americans sympathize with the Tea Party than the major two parties, something different is happening out there. A lot of people are speculating, will the Tea Party actually become a third party? I don't know. There's all sorts of possibilities. But the point is, we won during the midterm elections. Can we win in 2012? Absolutely, I think we will, because the Tea Party is here to stay, no doubt about it.
Oh, I very much agree.
Well, let's start with the candidate, then-candidate, now Senator-elect Rand Paul, who, as I mentioned earlier, the New York Magazine called the Tea Partier-in-Chief. He made a good point during the election that when he won his victory, it needed to be by a significant margin as a mandate for the Tea Party, that they mean business, we mean business. And that's exactly what happened. He had a significant lead over his Democratic opponent. Now, what that means in the grand scheme of things with politics on the national scale is that the numbers are there to keep electing these kind of candidates. Rand Paul proved that. Many of the people who won in the midterm elections proved that. The Republicans gained control of the House. Going into 2012, looking at the future, what's different in American politics? As I said earlier, we need to sustain that, but I think to the extent that the establishment, I'm talking about the politicians and the media, begin to understand that, they're not going to like it. They're going to raise hell all the way through.
Well, of course.
It's going to be a reality they must deal with, and we just keep pressing forward, and we will direct the political narrative, and not them, as that's the way it's been in the past. We will tell them what we want. We don't want any more spending. We want lesser government. We don't want any more of the nonsense that Obama and the Democrats have been up to. But that's the important thing, and they will continue to get the message loud and clear.
Thanks for the update, Jack.
Michael, as always, I appreciate you having me on. If your listeners want to learn more, I encourage them to visit SouthernAvenger.com. Y'all take care.
We have shown through my book, Trickle Up Poverty, and the Tea Parties Around America, that we can make a change and stop Obama's Marxist agenda. I believe this was only the beginning, but we have to keep up the pressure to keep our nation alive.
Savage.
What else is in the news? Let's take a look at michaelsavage.com. The best little site on the internet. I specialize in stories and pictures, because I think one picture is worth 1,000 words. And the lead story is 34 warships sent from the U.S. for Obama visit with a picture of a warship. On the left, we see my new headline, The Fight Begins, Teach Friends and Family How Obama Plans to Cripple Security and Military, What's in the Health Bill. Go to your bookstore and buy Trickle Up Poverty. Obama says the election was not a rejection of the administration's policies. Interesting. Well, we'll leave that one. Republican rout extends to state legislatures. Well, we know Republicans are winning about 17 governorships. Portland, Maine rejected non-citizen voting. Voters in Maine's largest city have rejected a ballot measure that would have allowed legal residents who were not citizens the right to vote in municipal elections. Isn't that nice? I wonder how many non-citizens voted in that election to outlaw the voting of non-citizens. They lost anyway. Deceased California Democrat defeats Republican for state Senate seat. A woman named Oro Peza died on October 20th. But because her death was within 10 days of the election, her name remained on the ballot, and she won because of her name.
She can't do any worse. Mm.
No. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. MGM files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Authorities discover 30 tons of marijuana in a border tunnel. I can't believe that story. You know who was the biggest loser in this election? The Washington Examiner is saying George Soros. I hope that's true. I hope that's true. Read all about it on michaelsavage.com. Also, there's another story that I have to tell you about. This just came out. The White House called Brian Williams of NBC after he questioned the mail bomb terrorist threat. You're not going to believe this story. The White House called NBC's Brian Williams to complain to him because he hosted a discussion that questioned last week's terrorist scare from bombs on cargo planes from Yemen. Terrorism expert Michael Sheehan and foreign affairs correspondent Richard Engel discussed whether the threat was really viable on NBC's Nightly News. Williams referred to the plot as almost inept. The White House called Williams immediately after and told him, "We would never put the president out there saying it was serious unless that was the case." NBC had no comment. The White House didn't get back to us, says the New York Post. What's that all about? What's that all about, do you think? I guess that means that when one of their flax even questions, then they go crazy, right? Coconuts removed from trees in preparation for Barack Obama's India trip. I got to go back to that. Indian authorities have decided to go one step further by removing all natural threats to the president as well. They should just use a new neutron bomb before he gets there. So all coconuts around the city's Gandhi Museum are being taken down. I wish they were saying all the nuts around the city's Gandhi Museum in Washington, D.C. were being taken down. Mani Bhavan, where Mahatma Gandhi stayed during his freedom struggle against the Brits, is a visiting site. We told the authorities to remove the dry coconuts from the trees near the building. Why take a chance, said Mani Bhavan's executive secretary. Huh. Last week, American security inspected this area, and they're afraid that a coconut could fall down somewhere near Mr. Obama. Well, I think what they should do is gather the coconuts while they may. And the reason I say that is because the First Lady likes to make vegetarian snacks from homegrown things. Why throw the coconuts out? She can make coconut snacks for others to eat while she eats hamburgers and fries. Don't you think that would work? There you go.
Let them eat coconut pie.
Look, I know you worry about what's going on in Afghanistan and what's going on in the White House, but with all of that, you shouldn't have to worry about your computer on top of everything else. So go visit my advertisers at carbonite.com. They'll back up all your important files so they're safe no matter what happens. Use my offer code SAVAGE, and you're going to get 2 months free with your subscription. That's carbonite.com, offer code SAVAGE. It's time in the show where I'd like to play some of the incredible audio sounds that we've collected here on the Savage Nation. Now that the midterm elections are over, you'd think the name-calling would be over. But here is powerful House Democrat Bonnie Frank, all bitter about the far right.
I just can tell you, I go back to Washington in 2 weeks in the lame duck session. And actually, compared to what it'll be next year, lame duck is probably going to look good by comparison. Because we're going to have a difficult time in which the far right wing dominates that party, and they'll get a chance to see what they really can produce.
Republican Congressman Mitch McConnell summed up the reality of the midterm elections when he admits it wasn't love of Republicans that allowed him to win the election. I'm sure he knows that. At least I hope so.
The voters didn't suddenly fall in love with Republicans. We know that. They fell out of love with Democrats. And while they may have voted to send more Republicans to Washington, they're sending them here with clear marching orders. Very clear marching orders. Stop the big government freight train and respect the will of the people who sent you there. The American people reminded us this week that we work for them, and we owe it to them and future generations to work together to find solutions to present troubles and to help guide our nation to better days.
Nancy Pelosi said that the reason her party lost the House and she lost her gavel was that they couldn't communicate well enough to the American people. Oh, I disagree. I think she communicated quite well.
I would say a very disappointing result, not being as colorful as he is in that description. But it was a tough loss. No regrets, because we believe we did the right thing and we worked very hard in our campaigns to convey that to the American people.
I guess the American people just weren't listening, were they, Miss Pelosi? They were just watching you whip them? Here's Rudy Giuliani already talking about the next election.
There was an article in Politico a couple of days before the election, and this was mostly Republicans and the cowardly ones, you know, who don't speak for attribution. And they are very afraid that Sarah Palin is going to run and going to do everything he can to stop her. They may have even said destroyer. These are Republicans saying that.
Yes.
And how about letting the Republican Party decide? Let her run. If she's as bad as you think, she'll lose. If she can really make her case, she will win.
Okay, Rudy, whatever you say. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. We're open to crop circles. We're open to prayer circles. We're open to seltzer drinkers. We're open to oil and vinegar shakers. Let me begin right here with a story from the book. When I, you know, every chapter begins with a homey true story. When I was 14, for example, I took a job in a drugstore in Queens, New York. It had nothing in common with the big name brand drugstores found in just about every neighborhood today. This was a simple mom and pop affair. I'll never forget the first time I met Doc, the pharmacist. Doc was an Italian immigrant from the old country who probably lived in a small apartment over the pharmacy. Thick set man, oversized shoe on his right foot. The heel must have been 8 inches high to compensate for a short leg. Unlike the sterile looking pharmacies of today with their harsh overhead lighting designed to give you a migraine so you buy more pain medication, I don't think there was a fluorescent light bulb in the place. You see, Doc's store had wooden shelves sagging under the weight of tonics and lotions and glass display cases with rows of first aid supplies and sundries. These were the old-time pharmacies. It even smelled differently. To this day, I still remember the distinctively pleasant aroma that greeted me the moment I'd walked through the doors of Doc's drugstore. I'll put it to you this way. It was as if the mahogany counters and floor had been scrubbed down with Old Spice and Lysol with a hint of leather. Whatever happened to that incredible smell? I should have bottled it. These days, drugstores smell like, well, I don't know, anything, and nobody knows your name. But with Doc, the pharmacist, you felt like family. Now, let's set aside the fact that he was paying me 50 cents an hour below minimum wage to save a few bucks for himself. To me, I was happy. I had a paying job on the weekends and after school. I was glad for the work and looked forward to going there. All I know is I'll be back in a moment on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Heartaches by the number, troubles by the score. Every day you love me less, each day I love you more. Yes, I've got heartaches by the number.
Let me continue about Docs. Anyway, I'm there, I'm underaged, I'm getting paid 50 cents an hour on the minimum wage after school, and I'm glad for the job. He made me into a pharmacist, in other words, while he ate his meal. Doc's wife, you see, treated him like a king. She'd bring in a big tray with a top to keep the veal parmesan or the homemade feasts warm. So he'd sit at his desk for the better part of an hour, savoring every bite. Preferring to eat his meal in peace, he'd make Michael, the little Michael, the pharmacist. I mean, how hard was it to fill out the prescriptions? All I had to do was read penicillin, 250 milligram, find the right jar that said penicillin, and then count out a dozen pills. I didn't need medical training to count the 12. He taught it to me in 12 minutes. He said, read the prescription. It says penicillin, 250 milligram. He said, make sure it doesn't say 500 or 750. And it says a dozen. You put it in the jar. That's all. 5 minutes. Said 12 minutes, I learned how to be a pharmacist. Now, the only time things got a bit dicey was on the rare occasion when some doctor wanted a blend of drugs ground together. You know, they still did that in those days. He'd ask for 2 milligrams of sulfur powder and a half a gram of phosphorus plus other ingredients. Now, these doc would compound himself. All I did was count pills, like today's college-educated pharmacists. So, one afternoon, I'm doing my job, counting out pills, minding my own business, while Doc was wiping the sauce from the edges of his mouth. In walks a guy in a dark suit and a receding hairline. He looked a lot like Robert Duvall as Tom Hagen in The Godfather. I glanced up as he approached the counter. I never saw the man before, and I had no idea what he wanted. So he studies me like a hawk through the glass, and he's watching me filling out the prescriptions. And then, with a fake smile, he says, "Hi, how are you, son?" "Fine," I said. Well, I didn't know at the time why he was scoping out the place. Something about him made me instinctively wary. So I said, "Can I help you, mister?" "No, no, just looking," he said. He raised an eyebrow like an IRS agent who just found an unreported nickel during an audit. His eyes darting around the drugstore zeroed in on Doc sitting beside me eating the last few bites of his veal parmesan. The next minute he marches behind the counter to Doc, pulls out his ID and says, "I got real bad news for you, Doc." I later learned he was a city government inspector. That afternoon, Doc got hit with a fine and I lost my job. It was a watershed moment in my life. Now, looking back, there have been two life-changing outcomes from those experiences working in the pharmacy. I came away with a profound interest in medicine, and years later went on to write several best-selling books on the topic. That's number one. Second, I grew to be leery of government intervention, particularly when a bureaucrat flashes a fake smile and pretends to he or she is there for my benefit. Can you blame me? Back then, I lost my job when the government stepped in. Today, I'm losing the best healthcare system in the world because the government seized this industry and now controls 1/6 of the economy. On March 23rd, 2010, with the stroke of a pen, our naked emperor signed a death certificate on what was once the greatest healthcare system in history and the envy of the world. Now, by the way, that sentence alone is the best sentence you've ever heard on the healthcare scheme. Our naked emperor signed a death certificate on what was once the greatest healthcare system in history and the envy of the world. He did so even after the overwhelming majority of Americans, a full 61%, opposed it, saying Congress should scrap that plan and start all over again. As the deadline for passage approached, an estimated 100,000 calls an hour from irate voters bombarded Congress. None of that mattered to Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, or Harry Reid. In order to usher in socialized medicine, these demon cats shackled the middle class with $2 trillion in new debt, reference 6. Not the $940 billion figure touted by Team Obama. That, according to the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, is the real cost of the bill's first decade. As the Weekly Standard points out, the CBO says we need to start the clock when the cost would actually start in any meaningful way in 2014. In other words, Obamacare is a ticking time bomb. It's set to explode after Obama leaves office, saddling us with skyrocketing debt, reduced care, and unprecedented invasion of privacy. The painful side effects caused by this bill will be lethal to the physical and financial health of Americans. And I go on, I spell it out for you, okay? I got to tell you this as a side note. I know you listen because this is one of the last places you can get real, honest, independent, conservative opinions and unfiltered news. And I want you to get the full impact of the Savage Nation. Go to TRN1.com, become a premium member, and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast at TRN1.com. Click on my picture at TRN1.com today. The name Mohammed is now the most popular name for baby boys in England. Mohammed is now the most popular name for newborn boys in England and Wales ahead of Jack and Harry, according to a report that just came out of the Mail Online. You know, it's amazing for me to sit here watching the death of the West in right in front of my eyes. We have an illegitimate president who stirs up hatred and is called a uniter. We have an influx of illegal immigrants into the country who are backed by a government. In England, they flooded their country with people from Pakistan who are now threatened to take over the entire country and convert it into a Sharia-following nation. And now they have Mohammed as the most popular name for baby boys ahead of Jack and Harry. And the Caucasians who live in England, I guess, are too busy partying on. Partying on. They don't want the nasty, nervous problems of raising a child. Why ruin your body, say the girls. Me stick around and be a dad? Are you kidding, say the guys? I'd rather just go to the pub and, you know, meet girls and have sex. I'm no father. I have no pride in being a father. Because the nation has... let me stop right there. I mean, what am I going to say that you don't already know? Mohammed is now the most popular name for newborn boys in England and Wales ahead of Jack and Harry. You hear this? So England, the people are screaming to the degenerate left-wing vermin who run the country, stop the flood of immigrants. Stop it, stop it, stop it. Pass an immigration law that stops the flood of Pakistanis coming in. They're taking over the country and they're threatening us at the same time. Open your eyes. I'm not making it up. The government then, in order to appease the population, says they're going to put an immigration cap in England. Then the CEO of General Electric goes over there, and Jeffrey Immelt tells the new head of England, Cameron, hey, we need those immigrants. We need them from India because they work for less, and we need them in from India. So take your cap and remove it. Take the cap off the immigration thing because we need more workers in England. And the head of England, Cameron, says, okay, we'll do it. So the people, again, count for nothing. The businessmen, if they were loyal, if they were patriotic, if they had some sense of manifest destiny, if they had some sense of nationhood, any pride in a nation, wouldn't be doing this. But that was then, this is now. I mean, I remember in my day, many businessmen were enlisted by the United States military to help win World War II. For example, the former head of NBC in those years was they made him General Sarnoff, I believe. They needed a genius in communications. And they used the man from NBC to help the army get out its message. That's when a businessman understood he lived in America. Now, could you imagine a General Murdoch working for the U.S. Army for $1 to help win the war against radical Islam? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't it be great if a General Murdoch could be employed by the U.S. Army for a dollar a year saying, I love America and I'm going to make certain that the nation comes before my profits? Or what about General Turner? Well, I don't know which side he'd be on, but he might be very good at propaganda, General Ted Turner. He might be happier working for the other side, General Turner. Although he's so bizarre, it's hard to say that anybody would want him to work for them. But you get the drift. Muhammad is now the most popular name for baby boys in England ahead of Jack and Harry. It's though I'm sitting here and watching the West die in front of my eyes.
All the stories have been told of kings in days of old, but there's no England now.
So there we are. I say things as I see them. It gets me in trouble. I am banned from the excellent dental care of my British cousins can experience. I've been dying to go over there now for 2 years to have my teeth fixed, but unfortunately I won't be able to do that. And of course, I would have loved to have gone for a nice tour of the British cuisine, but that's not going to happen.
I see. Seven.